Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Oregon. He's the author of Volcano, a memoir of Hawaii, as well as The Perfect Sound, a memoir in stereo. Gary Hungle's most recent book is Ocean of Clouds. How are you doing today, Gary?
I'm doing good, man.
All right. You know, let's begin our program by you reading and discussing the title poem of your new book, Ocean of Clouds.
Sure, be happy to. An ocean of clouds. I sing for clouds, constant rains, a fern chorus of things forgotten, ginger flowers of sadness my mother bore, enormous hollows of the family's past, my father, the dutiful son, come to run the store by the volcano, called by his father, promising a new life, its open door that swung shut after barely a year. They left. Me, still a newborn in their arms, wailing in complaint for the swift travel, headed to Kahuku, the new truck farm's old plantation and its steel sugar castle. I grew to six there, a boy barefoot on dirt and gravel roads, green temple moss by the graveyard. There were shorebirds in suits of slanting rain, a gray-brown surf, pebble-tossed, not fit for swimming, a tired sand spit's drift that marked the margin of all our dreaming. And what was that? The green folds of cliffs chanted our imagined names, caught winds heaving an ocean of clouds that piled like sea wrack, muffling the mill's whistle. Windrows of rain gathered upon the mountain's emerald stacks, the black crown of the day's celebration. Hidden within the sighing sugar cane, here I first raised my voice in harmless praise. I lifted my eyes to the moon's white sphere and sang a song I hoped would bless all my days.
You're listening to Gary Hungle reading the title poem of his new collection, Ocean of Clouds. You know, Gary, I listened to you read that poem, and when I read it, I thought of two things. One, I felt this poem is about you becoming a writer. It's also a poem that sort of echoes Walt Whitman, and it's also a poem that emphasizes your connection with nature. So talk about those three things. It's a little compound question there.
Well, yeah. You know, I wrote it just sort of kind of on the spur. I had been working on a long essay, a tribute memorial essay for Professor Franklin Otto, who had been vice provost at the Smithsonian and was occupied an endowed chair in history at Amherst College. He was one of the first scholars of Asian American literature. He's from Hawaii. Mm-hmm. From Kalihi, and we'd been friends since I was like, 18, 19, 20 years old. And it invaded my soul again, the idea of youth in Hawaii. And I just sat down and I composed this poem. I was actually in Paris. It's about the connection to that time, that place, those people, that landscape, you know, the double landscape of the rainforest and volcano and the big island where I was born, and the sugar fields and Ko'olawe mountain range, green cliffs on the north shore of Oahu. And all the things I did when I was a kid there. But then the poem sort of does make that turn towards acknowledging the reflective character of my nature from when I was young. I did used to sing songs in the cane field. I'd sit in a cane break and just sit there and make stuff up. And my grandmother somehow knew that I did that, and she would come and get me one time. And I was shocked she knew I was there. But it was about, yes, about becoming a poet and answering that what calls to your heart. And for me, it was, you know, landscape, nature, my affections, my loyalties like that.
Did that lead to your appreciation of Whitman?
You know, for me, Whitman was kind of a hard case. I think I write about this in The Perfect Sound, that there are two people I just did not get when I was in college. Mm-hmm. Maybe three poets. One was Langston Hughes, and one was Walt Whitman, and the last was Emily Dickinson, three great American poets, of course. So I remember complaining about Langston to Stanley Crouch, who was my teacher then. Yeah. And he said, he'd read this book and then come back and we'll talk in a week. So in a week we met and he said, okay, now tell me what you think. I said, man, it's corny, man. This stuff is corny. And he said, man, I hope you enjoy how stupid you are because nobody else does. And, you know, he was like that. And I went back and I got into the music of the poetry of Langston Hughes. Whitman was similar. I just didn't get it. And my teacher, Bert Myers, who was Stanley's, you know, really good friend in Claremont, where I went to school, they would just sort of, you know, talk shop about all these greats. And I would just listen, you know, Stanley would talk about jazz and poetry. Bert would talk about poetry and fiction and drama, you know, and I'd sort of sit at their feet. And then Bert would school me and I'd try to listen and hear Whitman. But it wasn't until I heard Equinox by John Coltrane on the radio. It used to be called Kago back in LA in those days, but it's called Kago now, yeah. And and I went, oh, that's just like Walt Whitman. You know, I heard the ostinato in Coltrane's Equinox, and then I thought, okay, that's what Whitman's doing.
Right.
Basically doing an ostinato in poetry, in language. And then he riffs off of it just like Coltrane would. Mm-hmm. Equinox. I go, okay, now I get it. I get it.
Now you get it. Now
I got all
it.
Energetic, you know. And I went back to the little pocket Whitman I had, and I read everything, like just eating it, you know. That's when I got it. I was just about to go to Japan in 1973 after I graduated from college. So Whitman came to me late, in a way. You know what I mean?
We're talking about late. I find it interesting that, and this gets into something that some of our listeners might be interested in terms of putting a book together. Why is this poem last?
Which poem? Why is that poem last?
Right.
Because it's a kind of
coda or something like that?
Kind of a coda, lanyap, if you will. Because what precedes it is an extremely long sequence about landscape or seascape, shorescape in France, and how I feel akin to it because it reminds me of Hawaii when I was a kid. And then there's a long sort of academic poem about Irish Auerbach and his essay, Figura. And I try to explain the function of metaphor in poetry. And it's, you know, they're long throes, they're long roads, each of these sections of the book. So I want to give people a little kind of like Philip, you know, little thing, little lanyap, you know, to kind of cap the book off.
Well, you did a good job here. Now, back in 2021, your friend, the poet Ed Hirsch, said Garrett Hungo is a poet of historical loss and personal recovery. What did he mean by that?
Well, it's hard to figure out what Ed thinks about, you know, in some ways. I mean, he's a deep thinker. I think he was saying that my work is informed by my knowledge of history in particular Asian American history, in particular Japanese American history, in particular Japanese American history in Hawaii. Four generations of my family, of course, were there, and which is nothing compared to how long Native Hawaiians have been there, of course. The other thing about personal recovery is about the recovery of those feelings that I intuited when I was young. My love of the landscape, my love of song, my love of people, common people, like my family was. And I think the personal recovery part is because I went through so many different changes. You know, I grew up as an adolescent in South Bay, L.A., and became very L.A., you know, and then college, graduate school, and then a year residence in Japan. So through all those layers, I'm still trying to arc back to some kind of impetus that I felt when I was a kid in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what he means by recovery. He also means the recovery of the forgotten history, of the forgotten people, forgotten experiences. Mm. And I think that's partly what it yeah, I think that's partly what he may have meant.
You know, when you say that, Garrett Hungo, I'm wondering how important is it for people to read your 1995 memoir, Volcano, to get a full grasp of your poetry?
Yeah, it's a kind of a disappointment of mine that people who react and love my poetry don't read the nonfiction, don't read Volcano. You know, it's sort of the big poem. I mean, my editor, Sonny Maida, when he worked on the manuscript together the first time, we sat down 2 days in a hotel in L.A., he turned to me, the first thing he said was, "Now, Garrett," you know, he's educated in Cambridge, he's a Sikh from North India. He said, "Now, Garrett, I know why it took you so long to write this book. It's not prose, is it?" Yeah, and it's a very, very poetic language that I fashioned after many influences, three of them American, three of them Japanese, three Americans, Emerson, Melville, and Thoreau, and the three Japanese, Mishima, Kawabata, and Yoshida Kenko in the 14th century.
Well, let me interrupt you there, because I want to ask you, I'm glad you mentioned those names, because I have a few names to ask you that you just didn't mention. When I look at your work, and this is what you're writing about also, I want you to talk about three people, well, maybe about five. First, let's deal with Charles Wright, who's your teacher.
Charles was my great benefactor, who invited me to study at UC Irvine, who protected me in a way, who gave me the open field so I could develop. But he also gave, you know, very, very canny and gentle guidance. He was not a prescriptive teacher at all. He was kind of, you know, what he says, ole, you know. But he's more than that. He taught me also manifold ways to hear poetry, not only within myself, but within the tradition. He released me into the poetic ear that, well, he schooled himself in. So I was able to hear the song in poets like Robert Frost, John Milton, Sir Thomas Wyatt, and how I could hear the connections musically among them all. And Charles introduced me. He was sort of the gateway to all that. His own poetry was a wonderful inspiration, because when I was his student, he was writing The Southern Cross, which was the great breakthrough book of his early middle career, that expansiveness, that dense imagery, that glorious and unfolding imagistic metaphoric line, that wonderful.
Might people say that about your own work?
Well, I can't compare myself to that.
No, I'm just saying somebody, maybe Ed Hirsch would compare your work to
the most finely tuned and expansive music that we have in American and literature, in fact, since Whitman and maybe Dickinson. He used to say he wanted to write a poetry that had the long line of Whitman with the precise imagery of Emily Dickinson.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about another person who you have a poem too in your book, Ocean of Clouds. You have a poem entitled Garland of Light. So talk about Robert Hayden.
Robert Hayden was also a gentle mentor of mine early on. I knew him in 74, 75 at the University of Michigan when I was studying Japanese literature as a graduate student. And you could take an elective after two courses in the program. I took Japanese language, Japanese literature, I wanted to take a course with Robert Hayden, I came to him and I said, what should we read? Shall we read this or should we read that? He goes, we shall read Keats. And so every Monday I'd bicycle over to his house and he'd have me read Keats aloud. It was basically, he wanted me to live in the glorious language of Keats. And then he would stop me and ask me to start again. And he said, try doing it with a little more, what did he say? Hear the pace underneath the words. Hear the sinews of the syntax. And he would say things like that, very gentle. And then I'd start again. And he was this incredible presence. He was so tall and skinny. And he had those Coke bottle glasses and a bow tie and, brilliantine hair. And she, I sort of was spellbound with Keats and Robert Hayden. And then at the end of the year, I created a student-sponsored poetry reading with Leslie Silko, Lawson Inada, May Bersenbrugge, and Etheridge Knight. Mm-hmm. And I invited Robert Hayden to be on the bandstand too. And he said to me, "I'm sorry, young man, I cannot accept your kind invitation, despite all wishing." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "He said I'm afraid I'm persona non grata at the Trotter House, which was the black fraternity where we were having the reading. Because in those days, the English department would never have a reading like that, Mm-hmm. And I went, "Well, why?" And he said, "Have you heard the term Uncle Tom, son?"
Yeah, he would criticize it at Fizz when he was there.
He said a few other things, and I went away kind of puzzled. I asked Stanley, "What the hell?" Stanley Crouch, and he told me about that Fisk thing when Melvin Tolson and people took him down in front of an audience.
The only person I think who probably came to his defense was probably maybe Julius Lester.
Yeah, well, good for him, So he said, I went back to him, and he said, "Though I cannot accept your invitation, I will attend." So I saved two seats for him and his wife in the second row because the poet sat in the front. And he came in late, just about as things were getting started, and he sort of shuffled into the row. And then I remember Etheridge Knight standing up. He says, "The great Robert Hayden has just graced us with his presence." He started clapping, and slowly the whole audience stood up and gave him a standing ovation.
As he deserved. Talking about standing ovation, just three other people I want you to talk about. You mentioned your time in Japan, so I wanted you to talk about Basho and Issa in terms of your interest in haiku.
Well, I got to be truthful with you and honest with you. I'm not a big fan of haiku. I am a big fan of Matsuo Basho, who brought to haiku his great learning in Chinese literature, Chinese poetry, in fact. He also had a music in his haiku, which was quite, to me, distinctive and distinct from much of the haiku otherwise practiced up to his time. What doesn't translate from Japanese into English is the sinews of syntax that Robert Hayden mentioned, the verbal music, the sort of incredibly fraught tone of how the poem is expressed. Haiku, in contrast to the great classical poetry of Japan since the 9th century, is an expression of the new class, the newly literate class of the cities as they arose during the Middle Tokugawa period, you know, from the, say, 16th century forward to the 19th. And it was supposed to be kind of more a poetry of the people, so that it had much more lightness, much more odd emotions, you know, like mockery and confession, if you will. They didn't have the stateliness of the prior poetry. But what Basho was able to do was, within that conflict of rhetorical and musical styles, he just threaded the needle between them. He brought them both together in a great and beautiful work. It's not only reflected in his haiku, but also his haibo, his prose writing, which is highly, to me, both hosoi, thin, sprightly, whimsical, light, but also yo elegant, very elegant, very stately at times. And he was able to work both of those tones in the way he wrote, depending on what he was responding to in the landscape. He's a great hero of mine. Issa is different. Issa, in some ways, is the more folkloric kind of poet, but he also emotionally has incredibly lightning command of deep, dramatic, changeable emotions. And so, in some ways, his haiku are even more dramatic than anyone else. He comes from the comic tradition, you know. What is one way to translate him? Look out, fleas, I'm rolling over, you know. And it's delightful, but he also turns to things like the death of his daughter. He said, they say it is a world of dew, and yet, and so he's like somebody like Adam Zagajewski in Polish. He can just slice that emotion and go towards the tragedy, you know. He's extremely powerful like that.
I want to make a connection to something you said, getting back to Volcano. And you were talking about the, you know, how people are looking at it, prose and poetry. But you mentioned Heiburn, and I was wondering whether there's any aspect of Heiburn prose that might have snuck into Volcano.
Yes, but it also gets there from a study of 14th century Japanese prose literature, what's called bungo, classical Japanese prose. And that, in the hands of someone like Basho, is responded and included in the Haibun tradition. I thought a long time about things like this, you know, how I could do that in English and have a kind of weightiness of the bungo, but also the fleetness of haibun. And I move through those, I try to move through those in the book Volcano. When I write about the volcano, when I write about the rainforest, when I write about my family.
Well, let me interject. When you're talking about that heaviness, how does that translate into like sound? Is it a heavy sound, light sound?
There's a heaviness of sound. There's a kind of stentorian tone. There's a kind of, you know, kind of like Eugene O'Neill at times, or Melville in the darker parts of Moby Dick, you know. Not the joyousness, say, of someone like Emerson in some of his essays. But I would say Haibun is more like that part of Emerson, which is spiritually joyous, like a poet or nature.
Well, let's make another leap.
Yeah.
Think what you just said. Pull that into the blues, which sometimes is joyous.
Oh, yeah, well, the blues. Okay, man. It goes back to when I was a teenager in L.A. I fell in love with the blues because I hated school so much.
That sounds like a blues line right there.
Yeah, and I fell into listening to the blues, you know, first because of Cream, Eric Clapton, and I did understand this song, Crossroads, that was written by R. Johnson, you know, on the label, an album. So I looked R. Johnson up, and I found out it was Robert Johnson. Yeah. I got the Robert Johnson record that was available on Columbia, And I went, wow, this is crazy. Wow. It was, you know, I didn't know it then, but it was like that heavy music of the Japanese tanka, you know. And my brother then picked up the guitar. I tried to play, but my brother was just amazing from get. He's 3 years younger, and within 2 weeks he could play the blues, you know, in a way. And we just listened every morning, and every day after school we'd listen to the blues, you know, everybody, Albert King, B.B. King, the British guys, even Johnny Winter, who, you know, turned out to be Charles Wright's cousin, you know, and we just internalized all that. As far as the feeling goes, I think for me, the darkest blues, like Robert Johnson's, is what has the heaviest, strongest influence. Mm-hmm. That sort of muscular cadence and that sort of grimness of inevitability, you know, karma coming to get you, hellhound on my trail. Mm-hmm. You know, wow.
Yeah. Okay, before we get another wow, and maybe take a little break, I want you to close out the first half of our program by you reading Sunny Stitt at the Lighthouse.
Oh, yeah. This is a long poem, man.
Yeah, well, we got that, and then we'll take a little break.
All right.
So you can catch your breath.
This is a long time ago. Sunny Stitt at the Lighthouse. Hermosa Beach, 1970. I'd go alone nights to the wide street that led to Hermosa Pier and the dark sign Pacific beyond. I'd park a couple blocks away on a hilly street by the Dairy Mart and stalk down to the club, a dive with a $6 cover and 2-drink minimum that let minors in so long as you paid. I did, and heard the greats of the time blasting from the bandstand, bending the melodies of tunes I barely knew, playing off the beat sometimes, counting not the house with a peep from their eyes during a long solo, but on inspiration to take hold and lift us all from our small oblivions to the starlit holy spheres. They'd start with something from the American songbook, or what's called a standard, a love ballad played achingly slow. Then after a chorus or two, you recognized a soloist would stretch out, improvising, adding variations, leaving off some notes, beginning to explore the harmonic pieties of a different order than the straight tune, exposing its implications, taking from its plainer statements the convoluted harmonic logic implied, the freer algorithmic forms emerging from its carnal fundamentals in melody. It was both abstruse and rootsy in these ways, the thrilling excursions of the solos always circling back to the plain statement of the initiating vamp, the tune's head. I'd heard of Stitt as a bebop pioneer, the man who took Byrd's alto style and brought it to the tenor, giving it something of his own. But when the man walked in, slow and gimp-legged, crossing the stage, I felt pity, a strange and intimate residue of awe transubstantiated. Stitt had hair like white cotton, a graying mustache drooping around a faint scowl on his lips, and wore a purple shirt that was so tight he'd unbuttoned it to mid-chest, exposing a panel of sagging flesh behind the green lanyard for his axe. The rest of his ensemble was a pair of brown gabardine slacks, tan shoes, and a heather sport coat freshly pressed and so big it hung more like a cape loose around his frame. "I've been sick a while," he told us, a small crowd, a couple dozen in a space that took 100. "Pneumonia, but I'm going to try to make it for you." His shoulders sashayed to settle in the space inside the coat as he wrapped himself around his gleaming instrument and blew, working its pearly keys with pliant fingers. Tune after unrecognizable tune came then, lugubriously, with big honking notes that sounded like blues with a bad stutter. When he stopped to twist his mouthpiece or to wipe his brow with a big handkerchief, Someone yelled, "Play Mr. Bojangles," and did it again between every song. Stitt stopped the set and leaned back in his chair, staring into space, his eyes working in slow orbits. "I'm sorry I made that record," he snapped, "with that green bowler on my head, those damn spats on my shoes." When I spun the LP later, its sound was middlebrow and plainly melodic, a step above A&M, but just as simple. Its cover art a photo that made of Stitt's elder status a kind of carnival figure, genial and welcoming, displacing the gravitas of his history with a cartoon image instantly, falsely agreeable. "Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, dance," the song lyrics say, achingly nostalgic about a prior order, a subaltern artistry meant only to please. I intuited his scorn was legit, and I deferred. He was a kupuna of jazz, a kumumele, and I've since felt the same, society preferring my caricature to the real of any being. "Bad for grass," the bumptious Asian gardener says to Nicholson in Polanski's Chinatown, a spoof on his accent that turns the plot. And my own rage is taken as a silly thing, comedic, impotent as the Chinaman in Nicholson's racist joke. Stitt turned on the request. "I'll play How High the Moon," he said, and ripped that tune apart, taking the chords to their outer reaches in bebop speed and angularities of progression. It lifted us from our small oblivions to the starlit spheres, an empyrean of improvisations emerging from its plain melody. When it was over, Stitt had slayed us into silence and said, "Now I'll play a ballad," looking around to his sidemen. "How about Round Midnight?" said the man on bass. And they took up the mood, playing like gods, stately in their own space, the air and audience syncopated around them, droning with the bowed strings, a lasting part of it.
You're listening to Garrett Hongo, and we're going to take a little break right now. The show's on the margin. My name's Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace! This is the social justice calendar for the week of August 18th, 2025. From Thursday, August 21st to Saturday, August 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., there will be Dreaming Out Loud, Black Farm Community Supported Agriculture Program at Marion Barry Avenue Market in Washington, D.C., located at 1303 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast. This initiative offers fresh, locally sourced produce, all black, brown, and women-owned, and values-aligned farms with options to add eggs, honey, and other local goods. For more info, visit www.dolgrocery.org. On Thursday, August 21st, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., there will be an event titled Black Power Scorecard, Measuring the Racial Gap and What We Can Do to Close It, with author Andre M. Perry and Jamise Harper, located at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. On Sunday, August 24th, from 1 to 3 p.m., there will be Intervening in Internalized White Supremacy Violence, hosted online by DC Peace Team. Attendees will be guided through practices that support reimagining themselves outside the scripts imposed by white supremacy. For more info, contact Francis Gortier at fgortier@dcpeaceteam.org. Finally, on Sunday, August 24th, from 7 to 9 p.m., Sankofa will hold Sudan on Our Mind, community gathering to share and reflect on powerful stories of conflict, resilience, and hope from Sudan. Located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. Consider making a donation to support WPFW's Summer Pledge Drive by calling 800-222-9739. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the air with my guest, Garrett Hungo. Garrett Hungo is a distinguished professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at University of Oregon, and he's been reading this morning from his book, Ocean of Clouds. I want to get back to, you know, we're listening to that poem that you read, Sunday Sit at the Lighthouse, and I've thought about how often audience want to hear a person's popular work, right? And I remember, you know, go to poetry reading with, and Nikki Giovanni, you know, just passed away, would be reading, and everybody says, I want to hear Ego Tripping, you know. And so I wonder, Garrett Hungo, do you have like a signature poem that, you know, that you close out a reading with, or somebody said, Garrett, you know, play Mr. Bojangles?
You know, I don't think I've ever reached that level of I've had requests, you know, from my first book, you know, people like the poem, What For, you know, a poem about my father, in devotion to my father. And it's written in a kind of Whitmanic ostinato, what's called an aphora, you dig. Every once in a while, somebody would say they want to hear the poem I wrote in Hawaiian Pidgin from Coral Road, you know, in the voice of a Hawaiian blues singer, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know, but no, I've never had a lot of that kind of reception, you know, where I'm in the common. I don't think I never expected it, and I haven't run into that much.
We thought you were the James Brown of poetry, Garrett Hungo.
Yeah, well, that's hardly the case, you know. Nobody's James Brown except James Brown, you know.
Well, look, recently, the scholar Dana Williams, who's here in Washington, D.C., she published a book called Tony at Random, which is about Toni Morrison's contribution to literature as an editor. You've been publishing with Knopf for a period of time. Who are some of the editors that you worked with? And how did they sort of, say, guide or, you know, move your work along in terms of its development?
I've had wonderful editors. Number one, each of them was a sponsor and a supporter and an encourager. Alice Quinn chose The River of Heaven, my second book of poems, out of the slush pile at Knopf. And, the truth be told, in those days I had an agent. Well, I still have an agent. And she wanted to sell Volcanoes, so we threw The River of Heaven out there as a sort of enticer, you dig?
Appetizer.
Took it right away. And then she told Sonny Mehta, who was president of Knopf, about my proposal to write Volcano. In those days, I only had one chapter as a sample. And they signed both books up, you know. So I had, and then Alice quit. And she went to edit at The New Yorker. And I went, oh my God, what the hell's going to happen to me? And guess who took over? It was Harry Ford, the great editor from Athenaeum, who, you know, edited W.D. Snodgrass, Mark Strand, Philip Levine, W.S. Merwin, and on and on and on.
What kind of feedback? I mean, here you have it. What kind of feedback are these editors giving you? Are they saying, go revise this? Are they saying, oh, this sounds like such and such, or maybe you should read more? What are they actually doing, you know?
Just like Charles Wright, man, mostly they just said ole, you know? Sonny, when he edited Volcano, had very interesting suggestions. He made a few cuts, but mostly he said, can you talk more about pahoehoe? You used the word, and tell me what it is.
But that's prose. How does somebody correct your poetry?
Harry Ford, you know what Harry Ford said? I wouldn't touch a word. That's what he said. So then I ended up with Deborah Garrison, who took over for Harry when Harry passed away. And Deborah was extremely acute as an editor of Coral Road. She had a lot of ideas, and she reorganized the manuscript, or she asked me to, and she asked me to cut quite a bit from it, and she sharpened it, and she helped me shape it. She had a lot of really great suggestions. I don't think she said, you know, write more of this, but she just made some cuts and sort of suggested reorganizations.
Let me ask you a key question, Garrett Hungo. If you look at your career, were you more listening to an editor in your early career as opposed to now you say, well, you know, I know what I'm doing, or somebody just says, oh, it's Gary Hungo's work, and they don't even say anything about editing it. They just say, okay, it's Gary Hungo.
I have to be careful in answering this because I have not been edited like that. I've had gentle suggestions, and occasionally suggestions that I drop things from a collection of poetry, say. Deborah also edited my last memoir, The Perfect Sound, and she had a lot of edits on that, but they were, I would say, judicious, you know.
Let me make it difficult for you, Gary Hungo. So make it difficult. So you're in either Miles Davis' band or Charlie Mingus' band, and you're not holding your own. What are they saying to you that is going to encourage you as a musician?
Off the bandstand if I wasn't holding my own. I've seen Mingus, man. No, he would have just stopped the music and kicked me off, you know. Miles, it's interesting. I'd have to speculate, but Miles would listen to your own mistakes. This is a story from Herbie Hancock, mm-hmm. and go, you know, there's something to that. Let me try this. And he'd like to respond to mistakes or unintended notes.
If you go back and look at your early work, Gary, do you see mistakes in it?
I don't. I to tell you the truth, I don't. I have a music, you know, and I write to that music. And once I found that music, which was with Charles Wright and Charlie Williams and Howard Moss at Irvine, I always was able to hear it. And so the words are tuned to the music that I hear, and that's the guide. And if it's not, then I usually don't show it. Mm-hmm. But I would say that what I could see as mistakes would be mistakes of attitude and emotion.
Okay.
Frequently, let's say people like us who've grown up under certain kinds of oppression and assigned subaltern status have a kind of anger or rage. And we have to, in some ways, overcome that to bring love to the table. You dig? Mm-hmm. And sometimes the rage, though, misguides us. And that I would say, has been mistaken in my work, perhaps. Also, my mockery, my disingenuous condescension towards something in or others. Like, for example, I never liked Creed Taylor. You dig? I never liked CTI music, and I have a very, very low opinion of it. And I've said this in The Perfect Sound, I think. But, you know, that could be extraordinarily flawed and prejudicial opinion, too. Mm. And I realize as I've gotten older that what I held as my standards or my sensibility might have been governed by a need to assert myself out of the subalternality of what has been socially assigned. So that's a funny and strange answer, but that's all I can give.
Okay. Well, let's move from music and sound to the visual and have you read another poem. Read on a photograph of civil rights demonstrators.
Oh, yeah.
And talk about that, because that gives you, you know, that's such a striking image coming out of that sanitation march in 60.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. On a photograph of civil rights demonstrators. A man wearing a sandwich board walks within a throng. Across the board's face and back, bold letters read, I am a man. He feels a change is going to come, and it won't be long. With 200 others, he protests to right a grave wrong. Unfair pay for those he thought less than men. He took a stand. Since Dred Scott, our country's laws have kept them down. Were they born by the river, as in Sam Cooke's gentle song? Were they running ever since? Does no one give a damn? Do you, like them, feel a change is going to come, that it won't be long? Since Dred Scott, our country laws have kept them down. There had been riots, assassinations, the war in Vietnam. When you see them, do you feel righteous or do you frown? In 66, I saw the man on television. This happened when I was young. From then on, I worried our policies were all a scam. Yet, moved by him, I believed a change was going to come. Back then, there were times I felt I couldn't last for long. Now I glance at this photograph that says I can. I feel a change is going to come, and that it won't be long. A man wearing a sandwich board walked within a throng.
Garrett Hungo reading his poem on a photograph of civil rights demonstrators. My question to you, Garrett Hungo, you know, especially looking at how this poem ends, how hopeful are you today in terms of the politics of now?
It's hard to be hopeful, but that's all we have to do. You know, that's the energy we need to muster in order to look for a better day. One reason we all look to literature and art is to build that hope, to rebuild that hope, rekindle that hope. Sam Cooke's song, You Dig, is to me a kind of pillar of confidence that things can change and it won't be long. Mm. It's always been an inspiration.
Mm. When you look at this poem, are there other poems in terms of, you know, maybe with your students, that you say, okay, go to the museum, look at this painting, or look at this photograph, and then write? Is use it as a prompt? Or was this, for example, a photograph that's sort of like, you know, the one that came out of Mexico in 68 with the protests at the Olympics? You know, there's certain photographs that just capture the moment that people keep going back to.
Well, this is a poem I tried to write when I was much younger, in my 30s. And it was just the image, you know, and it didn't have the emotion or the music. And I read it at Brown University when Michael Harper had me out. And I remember three students standing up in the audience as I was reading the poem, putting on their coats and walking out. It was one of the first instances of the Dartmouth Review type protests against, let's say, DEI or desegregation efforts, You Dig. And it shook me up. But I lost that poem somehow. And I just rewrote it for this book. Mm-hmm. And I was able to enter into its spirit and into that photograph. And into that wish for hope, right?
Mm. So, well, this poem stands out structurally different because it's in terzets in terms of, you know, it's a little more, I mean, you have the longer poem, which is a sort of meander across the page, but yeah. In terms of this one seems to be very, and I noticed
the villanelle, you know?
Villanelle, right. And then yeah. I noticed that you repeated this, but in a couple other poems, you always seem to use throng a lot. I came across some other poems that you said the throng, like, you know, like the masses or something like that.
Well, it's better than thong, I guess.
Right, exactly.
I don't use no thong,
man. I'm glad about it. Well, let's hear, I'm sort of torn because, you know, this morning I was going back over, and I like in Marble and Light so much. Could you read that poem?
Sure.
And that's for your dad. And now this is where I find it interesting. You have in the book this poem before. It's one for your mother and then one for your father. So I look at that placement.
Yeah, they're dual elegies. And there is a section of the book about, my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a section about history, and then this one's about my own life, and this ends that section. It's called In Marble and Light, dedicated to my father, Albert Kazuyoshi Hongo. I once saw somewhere in a box of old financials, check stubs and paid bills, or leaned up against a dusty mirror amidst vials of nail polish and mascara cluttered on my mother's vanity table in the bedroom, an old 8x10 photograph of my father with two of his war buddies. It was a black and white studio shot, touched up so their faces looked like smooth marble, but sepia tone with a cast of weak coffee. They wore dress khakis, smoothly starched shirts with campaign ribbons across their chests, and a stripe or two on their long pressed sleeves. My father's bore none, but his black hair rode up like a glassy wave, slicking over one side of his head, hatless, unlike the others who wore caps. It must have been when we lived in Midtown LA, in the apartment house with a Hawaiian name on South Kingsley Drive when I saw it. I was 6 or 7, and he told me he'd been a guard at Nuremberg, passing lucky strikes to SS officers imprisoned there who begged for them before they went on trial. Zigaretta bitten, he'd say, his one phrase of German, and he grinned when he said it, as though it were the cheesiest joke of his life. He never told me one thing else about the war, except that he brought a Luger and a Leica back from there, that my mother made him sell. She no like war souvenir, he said, waving his hand in dismissal. In the fall of 1987, 3 years after he died, I went along to a memorial gathering at Arlington, the National Cemetery, invited there by my senators from Hawaii, themselves decorated veterans. I stood at the top of an amphitheater and gazed down at all the assembled of the 442nd that day, scores of old men in their 60s and 70s, gray and shrunken in their informal aloha clothes, their hair silver under VFW caps. Danny Noe, my father's teammate from McKinley High's football varsity, led me down the shallow steps, saying, "There are some guys I want you to meet." I staggered obediently along. About halfway, a group of less than a dozen men stood up as we approached, some reaching to take the senator's only hand. He slipped it free and gestured toward me, turning. "This is Al Hongo's boy," he said simply. Then, one by one, like mourners at a funeral, each of them shuffled up and shook my hand, some saying nothing but looking deep into my eyes, theirs glistening in the autumn light. One in a wheelchair backed himself out from the end of the aisle. His hands were in dark half gloves, and I saw trousers rolled up where his legs might have been. Then he pushed toward me, reaching, his hands beckoning me to bend toward him. I did, thinking that he might take the lay of green tea leaves from his shoulders and place it around my neck, that I would be kissed in greeting. But his hands reached past to my face, and I felt his free fingers rubbing a soft arpeggio against my cheeks and the hollows above my jaw. Slow strokes as though a dirge were in their touch, cadenced and resolute. "Your face the same as your father's," he said, the palms of his gloves rough as emery against my skin. And I was made marble, wet with the shining light.
You're listening to Garrett Hongo reading from his book, Ocean of Clouds. Thank you for that poem. I was wondering, Garrett, in terms of, you know, a poem like this, which is personal, how do you handle revision, or does this poem just flow out of you as a memory?
Well, much of the time, things arrive with their music intact, and I simply write the words to that music, you know, and that guides me in terms of the composition. And when it's off, it's usually off the music. If there's something irregular or incomplete or inadequate that I'm not skillful enough to render right away. So because the music is the guide, I can revise very quickly, go back and do it again, like a take, you dig?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Another take, another take, another take. And I usually do it all at once. And I don't do anything else until the poem is done. That's kind of hard with long poems, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's what happened with this one. I wrote it all in one day and revised it like that, like I just said, like in different takes. But chasing the music, you know.
Well, you know, as a last question, say you were opening act and, you know, we just heard you perform and stuff. What music should we be listening to that should come after you? You want to mention any musicians that you would say, okay, you just heard me talk. This is what you should be listening to.
The outro could be Duke Ellington's Sound of Love by Charles Mingus from Changes One.
Okay. Anything else you want to put out here?
Besides that?
Yeah.
I don't know. My Girl, I guess.
Any vocalists? Yeah. Okay. Any vocalists?
My Girl by the Temptations. The
Sensations. Okay. All right. Well, Garrett, you know, it's always a pleasure, you know, to talk to you and read your work. And I think that, only a final question. Do you feel, in this case, your career, because of geography, that maybe somebody in Birmingham, Alabama doesn't know your work as much as somebody like in, say, Oregon? Or do you feel like East? When we talk about jazz, it's like sometimes East and West Coast separates us by geography.
Well, early in my career, things were more together, I think. You know, like the second reading I ever gave was at the University of Alabama. There was a big crowd and, you know, there were mostly white folks and black folks, very few Asian folks.
Did they invite you back?
I've not been back since then, no. Back then, you know, there was a crew there around Black Warrior Review, Michael Pettit, Darrell Weir, Alan Weir, Greg Pate, Marnie Prang, that they were fans of my work. So they even offered me a job there one time. But I think that, you know, I'm pretty local these days. Like, my books sell mostly in California and Hawaii.
Yes. Well, I'm just gonna say this. I'm a big fan of your work, okay? And I'm glad that you woke up early, got some coffee, and to be on my show today, because I'm certain that, you know, our listeners probably enjoyed this hour as much as I did. And so I want to thank you, Garrett Hunkel.
Well, I want to thank you, Ethelbert, for hearing my song. You know what I mean?
Well, I was trying to sing along. That's what I was trying to do. Okay. All right. My guest today has been Garrett Hunkel. He's a distinguished professor in the College of Arts and Science at the University of Oregon. He's the author of Volcano, a memoir of Hawaii, as well as another memoir, The Perfect Sound, a memoir in stereo. His most recent book is Ocean of Clouds. So my name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin, the station story, PFW 89.3 FM.
Are you ready to move, groove, and exercise with the WPFW family? WPFW's annual 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness happens Saturday, September 13th from 8 a.m. till 1 p.m. This fundraiser will be held at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. In addition to a scenic 5K trail, fitness and wellness classes will be offered. Lively music to fuel your participation in the activities, along with water and healthy snacks, will be provided. Details are at WPFWFM.org or call 202-888-5484. There's something for everyone to enjoy. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Karan Dance Company celebrates its 42nd annual National African Dance and Drum Conference, coming together as one on Labor Day weekend from Friday, August 29th to Sunday, August 31st. The conference workshops will take place at the Washington Marriott Capitol Hill and will be taught by 20-plus master dancers and drummers from Senegal, Mali, Guinea, Liberia, and the Republic of Congo. This year's concert performance will take place on Saturday, August 31st at 8 p.m. at Howard University's Crampton Auditorium and will feature guest artists from across the U.S. and Khan Karan's company and community class family. Details can be found at www.kankoran.org, that's KankoRan.org, or by calling 202-518-1213.